Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 98-year-old Don Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah. He served in World War II with the 9/11th Air Engineering Squadron. We're going to hear later on how he was wounded near the end of the war in Europe, but I didn't get a chance to ask you yet, Don, what you remember about December 7th, 1941, and how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor as an 18-year-old, I guess, here in Salt Lake City.
I remember that there was a bunch of Japanese people right around us, and they were severely chastised. People wouldn't talk to them. If they were walking on the sidewalk in front of them, they'd throw rocks at them. And yet, it wasn't their fault. I mean, they didn't cause a war. It was a country, but people didn't think that way. They just, a Jap was a Jap, and that's all there was to it.
Had you gone to school with Japanese Americans?
Oh, gosh, yes. Some of the best classmates I ever had were Japanese fellows. I wish I could remember their names, but you know, there's a lot of years between 98 and 12. We had a lot of friends like that. We played with a lot of them.
So you mentioned your friend, Bill Christensen. You mentioned you both decided to go in together, but that he was killed in the war. And of course, you were wounded in the war. Yeah. But do you know what happened to Bill?
No, I don't. I wish I did, but I surely don't. When I wrote a letter to him, I told him I couldn't swim, so they sent me over to Europe. And I had communication with him for, I guess, for about 6 or 8 months. But, you know, you could write a letter and it would take it 6 months to get there. But Bill was killed over there in that half of the world. And I got banged up at Kassel, Germany. I decided that the war was over for me, I think. So I stepped on this landmine and the damn thing went off.
I'm going to have to ask you more about that, but I want to hear about the early times in the Army. So you decide to go in. Do you remember what you thought Army life was going to be like, what your expectations were?
We never expected our life to be as, how should we say, as stinking as it was, newly in. And so we were picked on. The guys had been in there for 6 or 8 months. We were just rookies, and they would just pound the salt at us, and we'd have to do all the dirty work while the other guys had their portion of the operation. We didn't practice shooting and killings and so forth as people would imagine, but we did picking up and hiding and digging in. Digging in the foxholes was the most prominent thing to learn how to do, because they told us that when we got over, we would probably live in foxholes. Well, we had no idea what a foxhole was until we started digging them. And then we found out in a hurry that a hole in the ground wasn't necessarily a good thing either. But we had them, and we worked our butts off digging them, and then along would come a bomb and cover up the foxhole, and we'd have to start all over again.
Where did they send you for training here in the States before you headed over?
Down to California, Camp Tanforan. We were fenced in. We couldn't get out. You'd imagine that we were going to run away or something. And I remember when my dad got into, I guess you'd call it civil service now. But anyway, he was responsible for making all of the automobiles and everything else run during the war. And they wouldn't let him inside the camp. It had chain link fence all the way around it. So he stood on the outside while I stood on the inside talking to each other. And they'd only allow us to talk to them for a period of maybe 5 minutes or so. Then they'd pull you back in away from the fence, and that was your visit. It was a crazy way of life, but it worked out pretty good. We came out on top.
And you ended up in a fairly unique unit in the Army. How did that unfold? How did you end up in the 911th Aviation Engineers?
We had to service all of the transports. When a ship had come in and it was in bad shape, we had to overhaul it, put it back together, make it airworthy. They used to tell us, you get to take it first. If it works, then we'll take it. And lots of times the old ships didn't stay up very long. C-47s, that's just like the old airlines. They didn't last very long. It vibrated itself to pieces. but it was a good way of life as long as we were in the States. It was when we got over that it was crazy. We had English, God bless them. We never had anything like it. They had certain things they would do. We just fought them tooth and toenail. We didn't believe in that kind of crap, but it didn't make any difference. You didn't change them. They still stayed that way.
What would be an example of that?
At lunch, they would all quit what they were doing and go have lunch. And if we were digging a hole or taking care of something, we took care of that and ate lunch afterward. They couldn't understand how come we could do it. We just like went crazy with them, those people, because all of a sudden somebody'd holler, "It's tea time," and everybody'd stop and have a cup of tea. And we used to get so stinking mad if we were with any of the English at the time. We'd tell them to pour that stuff in the sewer and let's go to work. But after about, about 6 months or so over there, we learned to drink the tea the same as they did, because that was all you had for water. When somebody would say it's tea time, it was 10 o'clock. After you had lunch, if it was tea time, it was 2 o'clock. We used to think, geez, what a way to fight a war. It was crazy. They were wonderful people. I met some of the most wonderful people in the world over there. Their names, Charles and Catherine Christmas, and their son, Pat Christmas. And I used to think, what a crazy name. And so when I got home, I checked it, and Christmas is quite a common name. But they were wonderful people. Dell and I were on top of a haystack, and we were watching the Germans go over. All of a sudden, this lady was hollering, "You damn Yanks! You damn Yanks! Do you want to get killed?" We looked over the edge of the old haystack, and here this lady was hollering at us, "Get down! Get down!" So Dell and I climbed down, and we went over to their home. I never will forget it. They had they called it a cupolo. We called it a shed. They built a shed on the outside of their house where when they would go out or when they'd come in, they'd go in this place, shut the doors, and then open up the door to the house because there was too much light going out and they were afraid of having bomb problems right there. And Dell and I got so that we realized how serious these people were, because we went through several bombings and we lived with these people. When I say lived with them, we were sleeping on their floors. We thought there's got to be a way of thanking these people. I never will forget that. So we handed her 2 pieces, 2 and 6, which is roughly 50 cents. And she absolutely refused to take it. She wouldn't take it. So when we'd sat down the sofa in their house, we'd drop coins down in between the cushions and so forth. And then when she'd pick them up and she'd say, "Did you boys lose these?" Dell and I'd say, "Nope, we didn't lose them. It's not ours." And she'd say, "Well, it's not ours." And we'd say, "Well, losers, keepers," and told them that was theirs. If they found it like that, it was theirs. Even when I came home, when I was writing to them for some time before they ceased writing, we would send money over, because you couldn't imagine how these people had to live. Leastwise, Dell and I, we lived better in the army than they lived in civilian street. They always had a big pot of coffee on a hook hanging over an open fireplace. And so we'd go over there, and when she'd say, "It's tea time," she had a big dipper, and she'd dip it out of the pot and make a drinkable tea out of it. So Dell and I just couldn't figure them out, just how they could live like that. But boy, they sure did. There was more like that than there was otherwise. We had Pat Christmas. Pat was their son. And as soon as he was 14, now, not 16, 14, he joined the same thing as the army, and he'd had to go out and go practice and run and hide, fire a rifle at the German planes. It was quite an interesting and serious way of life over there, especially when we'd watch the Germans go over. You couldn't hit them in 100 years with a .22 rifle, even with a .30-30, but they would always sit there and shoot at them, and Dell and I'd say, wasting ammunition.
And where was this in England?
This was right off the coast. I'd say about a mile off the Dover coast. When we went across the channel, every villager lined the streets. We thought it was going to be a secret move. The only thing about secret about that was that We didn't know where we were going. But those people lined the streets, and there was no such thing as army formation. You couldn't walk down the street in a company because those people wouldn't put it. They'd just charge right into you to grab the guys that they were familiar with and give them a goodbye kiss and walk right with them. We had people walking with us right down to the coast when we loaded on the barges to go over. It was a sad day. And when I came home, after I was home long enough to should have had better sense, I got married, we had our firstborn, and all this time I was still writing to the Christmases. I sent them the first letter, but when we had our baby, I just wrote a big piece of paper, "It's a boy," and rolled it up and put it in the envelope and mailed it over to them. I still have the teddy bear that they sent, and we thought, how much would it cost to send that all the way from one side of England, clear to the other side, and clear across the ocean, and clear across the United States? That cockeyed thing must have cost them $50. We wrote and told them that it was wonderful, and we appreciate it, but please don't spend your money like that, because it's hard. I sent, I guess I must have spent around about maybe $100 or $150 I'd sent back over to them, because that $50 over here was just $50. But over there, that $50 was about $100.50. And so we made millionaires out of them. I remember Dad Christmas used to say, "We're the richest people in the village." And I told him, "Don't spend it all in one place." Well, they couldn't. They couldn't even, didn't have a store there to spend it in.
And you mentioned Dell a few times, but you didn't tell me who Dell is. Who's Dell?
Oh, Dell was one of my buddies on the Army. The Army used to say, you got to have a buddy. You got to have somebody with you. You can't go alone. So Dell and I buddied up all the way through. The only time I lost Dell was when I got hurt. They sent me to the hospital, and I never went back to my outfit. I don't know what they did with them. But once you get out of an outfit like that, you never used to get back into it. But it was a wonderful way of life. It really was. Even when we crossed the channel, soaking wet, the barge we was on was more underwater than it was on top, because we were all soaking wet. When we got off on the other side, the first thing they said is, "Strip off your clothes and get some dry ones." We thought, now just where in the H are we going to get dry clothes from? There's no laundry. There's no nothing. So we just wore our wet clothes and let them dry on us, because that's all we had.
So when you talk about this unit, the 911th Aviation Engineers, so you guys were mechanics on C-47s and other cargo planes?
Yeah, on C-47s, P-47s, we had all of them that we were maintaining. We'd watch them take off, and we'd count the number taken off. Then we'd count them coming back, and we could always tell our losses because of the counts. When they'd go over in formation. When they'd come back, they were scattered all over the sky. And we used to think, geez, which ones did we lose? And we'd wait until they'd come down. The guys would always try to come back to their home field, but they didn't always make it back. We used to think, too many lives, too much lost. But it was a way things were going to go. But we'd hang in there with them and watch them. And when they'd come back in, we'd immediately run right over to them, help unload, then ask them, who did we lose? Because they never come back to the same field again. I don't mean again. At that time, the next time, maybe you'd get one or two more back home. But usually, if a ship was lost or if forced down, they were down in some other field, and you'd never see them again. They just disappear among the ranks where they were at.
And can you give us a taste for some of the specific things that you had to do on those airplanes? Were you working on engines? Were you patching aluminum? What kinds of things did you have to do?
I was supposed to have been working on engines. But the ships are so full of holes that anybody that could hold a riveter, why, they were the guys that patched up the holes. We used to think they shouldn't call these ships C-47. They should call them patchwork, because there was a lot of them, that how they ever kept afloat, nobody ever knew, because, some of them were just shot to pieces. We just hoped like crazy that the ships that we had and we were working on and the crews, We were just hopeful that they come back. But I would say one out of every 10 ships landed someplace else. They didn't come home.
And we're sitting here in your house in Salt Lake City, and you told me in this house that you lived in before it was built, which is a story in itself, that you welded the railing on the front porch I just walked up. Is World War II when you learned how to weld? Is that something that you did in that outfit?
Yeah, if you didn't know how to weld, you learned in a hurry because they need them like crazy.
Well, we need to take our final break, but there's much more to come with 98-year-old Don Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah. You can access photos related to Don's story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Check out the info on the Fort Douglas Military Museum as well. And we'll hear about Don's most harrowing moments in Europe during World War II when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.